Hey, everybody. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so as we discuss recent developments in the world of public safety labor relations. This month, we'll travel down south to Louisiana for a pair of cases involving union speech, and that's the good case, and a particularly messy police chief, that's the less important case. Then we're going to go north, and we're going to go west, and we're going to end up in eastern Oregon, you might call it greater Idaho, for a crazy case involving fire department cuts, a recall election petition, lots of fighting words, and lots of lawsuits in response. Should be interesting. And then we're going to come back east, and we're going to talk with labor economist Jeremy Krimmel, who hopefully will calm our nerves about what's going on with the national economy. That plus a check-in on all things LRIS when we return. Welcome to First Thursday. First, what's up with LRS? Well, we just got back from Nashville, where we were last week for our collective bargaining for public safety employees. I got to tell you, it may have been the best LRS seminar that we've done, ever. I can't remember one that was as much fun. We had, if you've never been to our collective bargaining seminar, it's a lot of fun. We had spent 2.5 days just talking about bargaining, all aspects of bargaining. We had, you know, labor folks there. We had management folks there. We heard from Stu Davidson and Jonathan Downs for a full day, two experienced negotiators talking all about their experiences. Those guys, it's like watching a Broadway show. Like, I just laughed the whole time, but we learned a lot. You know, we had Rob Wexler from California. I think he's the best in the business in California, talking about economic comparability and how he deals with that at the bargaining table. I shared some of my experiences all around the country in bargaining. And then we heard from a labor economist, Jeremy Krimmel, who talked for an afternoon about, you know, the employer's ability to pay and things that we should be looking at to take the temperature of an employer, not just for the union folks, but for the management folks, to try to get a good sense of whether or not we can pay for a fair contract. That was a blast. If you have any interest in that stuff, we're going to do it again in October with different speakers and in a different location. We're going to be out in Vegas at the Paris and the Horseshoe from October 15th to 17th. And then we're going to bring everybody back to Nashville next spring. We're going to do it again because it was a blast. If you want any more information about those seminars, just check it out, lrs.com/seminars. And if you are downloading or listening to this podcast, like really quick after it downloads, we're going to do a webinar. We do live webinars every month, and our April webinar is going to be on April 9th at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, on privacy, public safety, privacy rights in the age of AI and digital surveillance. Wow, that's a lot. We're going to cover a lot of ground. It's an hour. We could probably do days on that, but it's going to be very interesting. If you want to check that one out, hit us up at lrs.com/webinars. Finally, if you appreciate the podcast, please follow or subscribe, or if you dig an episode, please text it, you know, to your friends or your colleagues. If you have any suggestions about things you want us to talk about or not talk about, email us at info@lris.com. And if you're feeling charitable, maybe you can even give us a review. Okay, our first case, as promised, comes from down south and from the great state of Louisiana. It's Louisiana State Troopers Association versus the State Police Commission, and it was decided by Louisiana's State Court of Appeal, their first appellate circuit, at the end of January. So I think January 30 was when the decision came down. Go check that one out. And so this one involves the State Troopers Association. That is essentially the labor organization representing pretty much everybody, you know, in the state police. Goes pretty high up the ranks, and also represents a bunch of retirees. The defendant in the case was the State Police Commission. The State Police Commission is established by the state constitution. It basically governs the state police, right? So it's got broad rulemaking powers to regulate all aspects of state troopers' employment. What else should we know about this case? Well, the Constitution in Louisiana is very strict regarding political activity by police officers. It's very strict. The case goes through, the specific provision of the state constitution that sets forth pretty stringent regulations and a few exceptions. But the bottom line is, if you're a state trooper in Louisiana, you really can't engage in any political contact at all other than exercising your right to vote. That's pretty much what it boils down to. The police commission has its own rules, right? Governs the conduct of police officers or state troopers, and it mimics the restrictions in the Constitution with a little more detail. But again, and there are some exceptions, but the gist of it is, look, if you're a state trooper in Louisiana, no political activity for you other than engaging your right to vote or exercising your right to vote. There are some smaller exceptions, but that's pretty much what it is. So what's the problem? Well, we have a union, right? We have the State Troopers Association. And the State Troopers Association has a political action committee. And the State Troopers Association, which is comprised of active and retired state troopers, right, does engage in political activity. They have a pretty active PAC. All PAC information is public information, so you can go and see how much they raise and how much they spend. They basically divvy out about like half a million or so in political contributions most years, and that's good. They should do that, right? You should be engaged in the process. But because the association is active in politics, somebody somewhere got the idea of like, well, wait a minute. The only way the association can make an endorsement, and they do endorse, and they publicly endorse candidates and oppose candidates and ballot questions, et cetera. The only way that the association can do anything is based on the political action of the members, right, who are active police officers. And through the association's bylaws, they'll endorse and they'll do that by a private, a secret ballot vote. They'll make contributions, the PAC will make contributions, and there's a similar process there. So the members have a direct voice in the political action of the association. And so somebody put two and two together. I'm not sure exactly, it's not really clear in the case, what happened, but somebody somewhere, the powers that be, made a threat and said, hey, if you're engaging in this political activity and you're voting in elections on how to spend money on political contributions or endorsements, any trooper who does that could be in violation of the law. So, maybe you should just kind of cool it a bit, or maybe you should endorse me and not my opponent, is usually how that crap goes. What happened here? Again, I don't know what the specific threat was, but I know that it was significant enough that the union or the association said, enough of that stuff. We're just going to sue. We're going to go to court for a declaratory judgment. When you ask for a declaratory judgment, that's basically when nothing has happened yet, right, in a situation like this, but you go to court and you ask the court to declare, right, that certain conduct is appropriate, or in this case, inappropriate. And what the union was seeking in this Louisiana case from the district court was, one, clarifying that the association, right, as an entity in and of itself, was not subject to the Constitution, was not subject to the police commission's restrictions regarding political activity of individual police officers. They also asked for a declaration that they have a con the association, right, has a constitutionally protected right to support or to oppose political candidates or issues, and also sought a declaration that membership by a police officer in the association doesn't violate the Louisiana Constitution or the commission rules, even though the association engages in political activity, right? So the association does things that if an individual police officer did, they would be jammed up. That's what the association sued for. They just wanted to kind of clear the air, clear the rules so that people could know what to do. And they lost initially, right? So they lost the trial court. The lower court held that there's no exception, allowing police officers to engage in political activity through a pass-through, right? And the lower court essentially said, hey, this is kind of a ruse. These are just police officers engaging in political action through this association. We think that that is exactly the type of conduct, even though there was a layer in between, the type of conduct that's prohibited by the Constitution and commission rules. So the court rejected the association's declaratory judgment suit. I can't talk. What did the association do? They appealed, and they were successful. And so the Louisiana First Circuit Court of Appeal reversed the lower court and rendered a declaratory judgment in favor of the association. Did the lower court, or I'm sorry, how did the appellate court approach that? Well, basically, what the court did was apply, as it should. There are different levels of scrutiny that reviewing courts will apply when faced with constitutional challenges. And here, what the appellate court did was apply the highest level of scrutiny that can be applied to a government, an alleged government restriction of constitutional rights, and that's strict scrutiny. And so, what the reviewing court said was that the association has rights separate and apart from individual officers who may be members of the association. And the court was very clear in looking at these issues that the association is a significant a barrier, right, between individual officers and political activity. So, how did the court arrive at that conclusion? Well, when strict scrutiny is applied, a court is supposed to very closely review the statute or the constitutional provision at issue and apply it to the facts. And here, the court very closely read the restrictions contained not just in the state constitution, but also in the commission's rules that applied to individual officers. And they said, no police officer, no state trooper shall engage in the following conduct. And I'm going to quote from the decision here, that gives us a sense of how the appellate court reviewed this issue. So, quote, the evidence at trial reflected that pursuant to the bylaws of the association, no endorsement of a political candidate shall be made without a prior secret ballot vote of the membership, with the majority of those members casting ballots supporting the endorsement. This endorsement is an endorsement by the association, not by its individual members. Likewise, a contribution made to an endorsed candidate following a vote of the affiliates, the members, pursuant to a previously approved budget, is a contribution by the association as opposed to a contribution by its individual members. And that's how the court read it. And you can't really read it any other way. The endorsement is by the association. The endorsement is, or the contribution is made publicly by the association, not individual members. And so, because of that, and because of the strict scrutiny that's applied in these cases, the court held that a declaratory judgment was appropriate. The association is not subject to the state constitution or the commission rules governing the activity of members of the police service, and that the association had its own right, to support or oppose candidates, and all of that falls within the speech rights, the expression rights of the association, as opposed to the individual members. So, interesting case out of Louisiana. Practice tip here: that's why you have a state association or a local association. If you're in an individual department, and let's say the president of your union is an active employee, and we want to make some type of public statement or maybe engage in an endorsement, well, I don't have the folks who work for the department be involved in that. Bring in somebody from the state. Bring in somebody from the outside who doesn't work for your employer, your particular city, but they can make an endorsement on behalf of people or report the position of the association. Don't tempt fate. If you can bring in another level, right, or two in between the active officers, the active firefighters, and the political action, that only makes sense. And that's what most groups do. And in this Louisiana case, at least tells us in that state right now, under that decision, that's completely appropriate conduct. The second case out of Louisiana, both these cases, by the way, in fact, all three of the cases that we're talking about this month are in the April newsletter, our public safety labor news document. So we pulled all three from there. I thought it was funny. We actually have two Louisiana cases this month and two Oregon cases. That's just kind of how they shake down. The second Louisiana case is not necessarily the most important case in the world, but I liked it. It's called State v. Bratton, 2025 Louisiana App, Lexus 331. It was decided by the Court of Appeals earlier this year. The reason I included this case, it's a criminal case. It involves a police chief that, you know, there's a lot of missing evidence, and there's a, all of a sudden it was in the police chief's car. So lots of cash and lots of drugs, not lots of drugs, but enough drugs in the police chief's car that resulted in a prosecution. I just love his defense was that I keep a messy car, you know, kind of messy. I don't know where any of this stuff went. Now, how the cash and the drugs got in his car in the first place, I don't know, but it's included pretty much for that. And there's a great quote from the judge in this case, quote, "Sadly, the explanation by Chief Bratton is akin to a school child asserting the dog ate my homework in an attempt to avoid responsibility." Yep. So, hey, I keep a messy car isn't really going to excuse the drugs and the cash in there. At least there were no guns. Good for Chief Bratton. Okay, it's time for us to leave the great state of Louisiana and go upward and westward to the other great state of Oregon, home of the LRIS staff, except we're on the other side of Oregon. We're in Eastern Oregon, sometimes known as Greater Idaho, sort of the part of the state that kind of would rather, you know, move over with Idaho. And that's no joke. The case is based in the city of Baker, Oregon, which is in the county of Baker in Oregon. And Baker County is one of a number of Oregon counties that actually voted via referendum to secede from the state of Oregon and join the state of Idaho. That is a long and a winding road, and we will just see how that turns out. But so that's kind of where we are in the state of Oregon. And what do we need to know about the city of Baker? It's like, it's small. It's like 10,000 people. They have a fire department. The fire department was small. Fire department was 15 firefighters. I'm going to assume some of this, but 15 firefighters, they performed medical work. So they had an ambulance, ambulance calls were about like 80 something percent. It was in the record of the call volume, not unusual. So this is probably a system where a small department, they're using the EMS side to generate call volume and maybe related revenue to subsidize the fire service part, right? Not unusual. But that ambulance work is really, really important to doing the other stuff. Okay, so we know the ambulance work is really important. What's the problem? The problem is in early 2022, the city of Baker decided to get out of the ambulance business. And the way those services are set up in Oregon, the city could essentially dump the ambulance obligation onto the county, and the county would have to pick up that obligation and cost. Maybe the services wouldn't be as good. Maybe taxpayers would have to wait a little longer. But hey, you know, it's not our problem. Sometimes we call those freeloader municipalities. So they decided to go down this road, freeload, get rid of the ambulance services, and make everybody else in the county pay for Baker City's services. Hey, that's up to them. But they decide to, or the city manager decides to make a proposal to eliminate ambulance services. The firefighters obviously oppose this, right? Because they know once the ambulance services go away, once the call volume goes away, there's going to be, the next step is to cut the size of the fire service. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. In March of 22, the city manager proposes to get rid of ambulance services. In April of 22, the 7-person city council in the city of Baker votes to approve to eliminate the ambulance services and to reduce the size of the fire department from 15 down to 9 firefighters, effective in September of 2022. What happened between April 22 and September 22? That's exactly what the fire department did. So they got rid of, you know, almost half of the department was lost as a result of this change. A pretty big deal. In response to that, one of the firefighters who left is a person by the name of Casey Husk. So Casey leaves, basically gets downsized out of the department. And Casey, whether on his or her own, you know, or it was the group decided to do it, but Casey decides to pursue a recall petition. So 7 city council people, 6 of them voted to get rid of the ambulance service. And so what Casey did was he went and he filed recall petitions for all 6 of the people who voted against the question, right? That's, you know, we talk about political action and political activity, and you got to make people pay a price, you know, at the ballot box and all that stuff. And, you know, my initial reaction to that is, all right, man, you know, like there's lots of ways to win a battle. You lose the first one. Let's go to the ballot box and maybe make a point. You'll see it probably wasn't the smartest decision, but what Casey did was he went you know, went through the process, filed the process to secure a petition to recall six of these seven city council people. So here is what the question said. So let me read to you what the actual question said. This is just one of the ones identified or targeted at city council person Johnny Wagoner, who wound up being one of the plaintiffs in this case. All right, I'm going to read from it. So during the spring of 22, Councilor Johnny Wagoner Sr. partook in the destruction of public safety in Baker City. He voted to send notice to Baker County that the city would no longer provide ambulance service. When Dean Geyer made a motion to disregard overwhelming public opposition several weeks later, Wagoner voted in support. Wagoner's consistent disregard for public input and lack of leadership has shown that he is unfit for the office he holds. It is not our intent to denigrate Wagoner's character. About that. Rather, we are here to hold him accountable for his errant actions in governance. It is the responsibility of the politician to heed the desires and the interests of his citizens. Serving in an American representative government dictates as much. Wagoner has not followed those guiding principles and shown time and again an unwillingness to heed public input. All right, here's where it gets good. Furthermore, he has directly sanctioned the dissolution of the professional fire department in Baker City, destroying the network of public safety that has been in place for more than 100 years. The consequences of this action must be the termination of his public service, as he put personal gain, fear, or incompetence, never underestimate that, above the safety and interest of the people. Okay, it's a mouthful. That was what was put forward on the petition. And then you have to go around and get X number of signatures to get that recall petition on the ballot. The sentence at issue there, and it was the same, they just changed the names, the same text for everybody. The sentence at issue there was that Wagoner directly sanctioned the dissolution of the professional fire department. Remember, they just eliminated ambulance service and there were significant cuts. They went from 15 to 9, but the fire department still existed at the end of it. So this goes through the process. The council people obviously are aware of the process, and what they decided to do in October was sue Firefighter Husk. And you know, that's an interesting approach. You know, sometimes we call there's SLAPP lawsuits, and SLAPP, S-L-A-P-P, stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. And so those are the lawsuits where, you know, you go out and, you know, a less wealthy party or a less powerful individual will make statements about somebody, and then that entity or person will send them a letter saying, we're going to sue you for defamation, even though they know it's not defamation. They know the statement was true. But basically, you're going to say, I'm going to sue you. You're going to spend so much damn money defending this lawsuit. Why don't you just retract your statement and go away? Otherwise, I'm going to bankrupt your ass. Maybe I'll lose the lawsuit, but I don't really care. That's a SLAPP lawsuit. There's been a lot of attention to those types of lawsuits in state legislatures and rules put in place to help defendants who are on the receiving end of these lawsuits. Oregon actually has one of those. It's called an anti-SLAPP lawsuit. And what that does is it provides an expedited procedure. If you get sued, you get hit with a SLAPP lawsuit, there's an expedited motion to dismiss essentially that you can file, that where the court will take a really quick look and see, is this a bullshit lawsuit or not? And if so, they can kick it really quickly. And that way you don't have to spend a ton of money. That's the point of these anti-SLAPP lawsuits. So Firefighter Husk gets hit with this law. And the question is it a bullshit lawsuit or not? Firefighter Husk gets hit with this lawsuit. And the allegation was that he violated the Oregon Corrupt Practices Act by basically making a false claim in his recall petitions. And specifically, the plaintiff said that his claim that Councilperson X directly sanctioned the dissolution of the professional fire department was false. And furthermore, the defendant knew it was false, right? No one was dissolving anything. That's the allegation in the lawsuit. So Husk initiates in defense, files an anti-SLAPP motion. So the court takes an expedited look at this. And basically when a court looks at one of these types of lawsuits, the gist of it is they're going to say, hey, is there what we would call a prima facie case? I get to use Latin. I love to use Latin. Lawyers get paid by the Latin word. What's a prima facie case mean? The Latin interpretations at first sight or on the face of it. So, like, if I basically look at it on the face, does it look like there's enough to support the claim? In other words, in real purple, you know, person language, the court looks at it and says, "Is this a bullshit lawsuit that's just being filed to shut somebody up, or does it look like there's like a valid beef here?" That's the Mayfair Northeast Philadelphia interpretation of law for you there, but it's true and it's accurate. That's what is supposed to happen. And so here, the court went through that prima review to see if the plaintiffs made a prima facie case, and it all turned on what dissolution meant. And the plaintiffs said, "We did not dissolve the fire department. Our action would not result in the dissolution of the fire department." And what's more, firefighter Husk knew that, right? He knew that that wasn't true, and he made it anyway. So the court looked at the claim. The court, you know, it's a pretty interesting review. The lower court rejected the or allowed the plaintiffs to move forward. This is at the state appellate court. Took a look at it, and they closely looked at what does it mean to dissolve? What does dissolution mean? And, you know, went through a bunch of different definitions, and the court just couldn't get around the fact that, you know, dissolution essentially means the act or the process of ending an organization, you know, or ending an agreement. Husk said, no, it could mean any number of things. It could mean like breaking into smaller parts. That's what I meant when I said dissolve. I didn't mean end completely. Court's response was this, quote, "We are unpersuaded. The definitions of dissolution applicable to an entity or an organization all incorporate the idea that the entity or organization ceases to exist as a result of the dissolution. In other words, Husk, the defendant, has not identified, and we have not found any definition of dissolution that includes the dissolved entity continuing to exist." That was pretty much it, right? End of story. The court goes on to address some of the arguments that Husk made, and you know, and points out, look, this was a misleading recall petition. I'm going to quote from the decision. "Nothing in the recall petitions alert voters to the fact that the Baker City Fire Department will continue to exist and continue to fight fires. Including such information could have tipped off readers that defendant was misusing the word dissolution, or did not mean it literally. Without that information, the statement that plaintiffs, quote, directly sanctioned the dissolution of the professional fire department in Baker City, close quote, is much more attention grabbing and can only be understood to mean what it says," right? So the court said, you know what you did. You exaggerated. And yeah, if you want to exaggerate out in the public square, I guess fine. But you know, you put this in writing and you were going to, you know, pursue petitions as part of a recall election. You can't make false claims like that in that context. And so the court determined that the plaintiffs did meet their burden to establish a prima facie case. And so the court refused to dismiss the case on the front end and allowed the case to move forward. Now, what wound up happening here? That's what I always care about. Like, what really happened with the recall petition? It never even got to a vote, right? So the rules, basically based on the population there, was in order to get the recall question to a vote in Baker City, you had to get 680 signatures for each petition. And so if that's the case, then we go further, and the council people could have done a rebuttal, and then it would have gone to a special election within 35 days, right? And so the petition was filed in September. We would have had something coming up pretty quick. The deadline to submit the number of signatures was December 6th. You don't have forever to do it. You have X period of time. They couldn't get the signatures. So, you know, the whole thing never went to a vote, and Husk got sued. And there was another defendant as well, part of that got sued. So it was kind of all for naught. You know, what's the, this is the next part, which is really crazy. The three plaintiffs, the three city council people who sued, right? Three of the people who were subject of the recall petition, their terms were up at the end of that year, the end of 2022. They were up. They were going to sit for, you know, re-election anyway in November. And in fact, of the three people, one of them was moving away and she wasn't running again. A second one just decided, I don't care. I don't want to sit for re-election. So only one of them was even seeking re-election. So a recall was completely unnecessary. And it was double unnecessary because two of the three people who were involved in the lawsuit weren't even going to run. So might have sounded like a good idea in the firehouse. You know, I'll show them. But it turned out to be a pretty costly mistake that didn't really do much. So pretty interesting set of facts there in Oregon. I don't know what's happening in the Baker Fire Department. If you guys know, drop me a line, let me know. Going from 15 to 9, not great. I'm sure their fire protection has suffered, but and it's good to use the tools at your disposal and political activity to oppose cuts like that. But you got to tell the truth. So please keep that in mind. All right, that's it for the cases in the South and in the Northwest. And for our next section here, we're going to go to the East and talk to economist Jeremy Krimmel about the economy. Okay, we're back with a real live person to talk to, not just me reading cases. And I told you we had that really, really great seminar down in Nashville for collective bargaining last week. And I'm going to talk to one of our speakers. He talked to us about just general things related to employers' ability to pay and things for unions and management to be aware of when looking at municipal finances in bargaining. His name is Dr. Jeremy Krimmel. He is a labor economist and a great friend of the show. Welcome, Jeremy.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rick. I'm really excited to be here.
Great.
It's always fun to talk about the economy, and as you can imagine, a lot's happened in the last few days, let alone a few weeks and months.
Yeah, it's not as much fun to talk about the economy recently as it used to be. And yeah, and that's what I want to talk about today, like not ability to pay or anything like that. I just know that people are things have changed, or at least there's a sense that maybe things have changed. We're coming off from the union side of the issue with respect to bargaining, like a multi-year period of really positive bargaining conditions and a pretty strong economy. And if I go by just what I'm reading in the papers, I might think, uh-oh, things might be changing. So let's talk to you about it. So Jeremy, what the hell is going on? So what's the state of the economy right now? Like, what would you say is happening with the US economy?
So right now, the economy is actually in pretty decent shape. And by that, I mean today it's in pretty decent shape.
And
So,
today, by the way, is April 1st. It's April Fool's Day, but this is all true. All right. So, but we're recording this interview on April 1st if the world explodes on the second before the pod. But okay, go ahead.
yeah, so, today we're actually not that bad, even though there's been a lot of rhetoric in the media lately, a lot of news articles coming out talking about some negative things, and that's true. There is a lot of uncertainty, but right now, unemployment is still low. We're seeing positive job growth. We're seeing good income growth. So the consumer is actually, pretty decent right now. Now that isn't to say things can change. There's a lot of uncertainty out there, and a lot of it has to do with inflation. Inflation has kind of leveled off the past few months, even kind of ticked up a little bit. So the progress on bringing inflation down has been a little slow. It's been a little stubborn. So, consumers are getting a little nervous about that. And there's also a lot of uncertainty out there with the current administration and some of the policy issues that have come up. We're talking about tariffs that might happen tomorrow. We don't really know. They might not. They might get delayed. They might increase. We really don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty out there, and it's kind of worked its way down to the consumer. So, rightfully so, people are antsy right now.
Yeah, it's so much of this stuff. You guys have an interesting career because I just cannot make sense of, all of the kind of voodoo that happens between people, how people feel and what we actually see, in the broader economy. But definitely people are tense. And how much of it is just, their own personal politics? Last year, if you ask a Democrat how the economy's going, they'd say great. And you ask a Republican, they'd say terrible. And probably right now, if you ask a Democrat how the economy is, they say terrible. And a Republican says great. So it's hard to find objectivity. But I think there are some things to be concerned about. And the thing that we touched on a couple of things. Let's start with inflation. All right. So inflation, what's generally like the target that the people who know about these things like to see, and where are we in relation to that?
So the target is 2%, and that's determined by the Federal Reserve Board of Governors.
Why two
Essentially,
percent? Like, what's the deal with
Well,
2%
quite
inflation.
frankly, it's, it could be argued it's a little arbitrary, but 2% is pretty much the consensus by the Federal Reserve Board and most economists, and that's kind of the point where it's stable. If you get inflation that gets above that, it might not be stable. So in other words, prices go up, everybody rushes out to buy something to beat the price increase, and then therefore that causes prices to go up, and it can have like a vicious effect.
So it's not so much, so it's like it's not the 2% versus 3% or 1% as much as the 2% indicates like stability and less volatility. Is that right?
Yeah,
Or
pretty much. That's a reasonable amount of inflation and to have. Incomes can, for the most part, keep up with that level of inflation. You don't get things that get out of control, which lead to bigger problems. And on the flip side, you don't want inflation to be too low either, because if it becomes too low or even negative, you get a thing called disinflation, and then people stop buying, right? What happens is prices are going down. Why should I buy today when I can buy tomorrow for a cheaper price? And then nobody buys, and then you get a recession
I would
or
think that
depression, maybe even worse.
I would think if prices went down, people would buy more.
So there's a short-term effect. In the short term, it's great. You can buy a little bit more. But say you're going to buy something big like a house. Today costs $600,000, but I know next month it'll be $500,000. I'll just wait until next month. And then if I do, oh, it's going to be 400,000 next month. And you kind of get into a cycle that's bad, really.
That makes sense. And so how have we been doing, with respect to the target 2%? I know that we had, I don't, can I say runaway inflation, but we had very high inflation in 22, right, into 23, and we got back down into the realm of reasonableness. What around this time last year, what were you guys, or what were economists, thinking in terms of how or when we would arrive maybe at 2%?
So, the 2% goal is kind of like a long-term goal. I don't think any economist thought that we would be down to 2%, this time, this year. Like, so in other words, if you were to ask an economist 12 months ago, where will inflation be today? It would be higher than 2%, but it would be a little bit lower than what it is now. So, the most recent readings are coming in around 2.8, 2.9, 3.0. Of course, there's some regional variations with that. Most economists probably thought we'd be around, 2.5 at this point. So we've made progress, but not as much progress as what we expected or what we would like to have made.
So, what's the consensus on what's behind that? Or is there consensus on what's behind that?
That's yeah. There's some varying opinions out there. For one thing, the job market's been really, really strong. Coupled with, when inflation goes up, basically the thought process is the Federal Reserve increases interest rates, they slow spending down, and with that you get a bump in unemployment. So essentially you're trying to slow the economy down. We've seen unemployment come up, a modest amount to around 4%. It's been hovering around that point. But it really hasn't been enough to really draw inflation down to that target level. So a lot of it has to do with the strength of the labor market. It's been resilient, quite frankly. And it's been a surprise to most economists.
It's been a surprise for the last few years, hasn't it? I mean, I feel like there have been, we've been kind of waiting, gosh, for the last 3 years for a recession. Everyone's saying, oh, a recession's coming, a recession's coming. And it just really hasn't come.
No, it hasn't come. And a lot of that is because of the labor market. It's just been so strong. I kind of think a lot of that dates back to COVID. We had a really sharp decline, and then we had massive amounts of government spending. So, people had money. So people just kind of kept spending. And it's resulted in, good job growth, low unemployment, and inflation that hasn't quite come down as fast as what economists would like to have because of that factor.
Well, so let's talk about tariffs. And if you could just talk a little bit about like tariffs generally. And maybe some things that the average, person like me might not really get. And my understanding is tariffs are okay. We're going to charge something to other countries to sell their products here. They do the same thing to us. Can you talk a little bit about what's really going on with that and how they work in the larger economic scheme? And then I also want to touch on how they might or might not impact inflation.
Yeah, so basically, a tariff is a tax imposed on a good that's imported into a country. So, say for example, an automobile is made in Europe, manufactured in Europe, and a U.S. consumer wants to buy that car. That would be an import. If the government decides they want to put a 10% tariff on that, it's essentially a tax on that good coming in. Now, if that car was produced in the United States, then there wouldn't be a tariff on it. So, in the basic sense, a tariff is a tax. Who pays that tax? Well, there's a lot of, dynamics that go into that. But at the end of the day, part of it goes to the consumer, part of it goes to the producer, and it results in, a good that costs more.
The producer directly pays that tax, right? So the foreign producer is going to directly is going to it gets hit with the tariff, right? But then the
They're the
question
ones.
is, are they raising prices to reflect that?
That's right. Yeah. So, the producer would pay the tax. However, there would be some kind of trickle down effect to the consumer. How much that's offset, we don't really know. It just depends on the market dynamics.
Are there any consensus studies or things that look at tariffs that might show kind of what percent of tariffs producers might generally pass on to consumers, or is that just too all over the map?
It's really dependent on each individual market. And it comes down to market elasticity. We can talk about that another time, Rick, but it comes down to market elasticity. More elastic markets, the consumer pays a little bit more or less, depending, same with the producer. So it really varies to answer your question.
Well, how does all this, impact inflation, right? So if a foreign a Toyota, if I want to go out and buy a Tacoma that my wife won't let me buy, if I want to go out and buy a Toyota Tacoma, they get hit with a big tariff, the expectation is they're going to pass maybe part of that along to me, maybe most of that along to me. I'd pay a higher price. How does that relate to just inflation generally? How do we track inflation, right? So how do tariffs enter into that formula?
So it's actually real simple. I mean, the tariffs get imposed. The prices of goods and some services go up. Therefore, you have an inflationary effect. Now, how much inflation will go up because of the tariffs? It's debatable. We really don't know. And some of these trade deals get really super complicated. I mean, if you think about like the car example, right? And let's just look at Canada. It's a little bit easier of an example in this case. Not only do you have a car that you're buying, maybe it's manufactured in Canada, you have tens of thousands of parts that are manufactured in Canada or the US or elsewhere. And through the whole production process, they're crossing borders multiple times back and forth. So how do you account for that tariff? Does it get hit once at the end? Does it get hit multiple times? And then there's a cumulative effect. So the actual impact, we're not really sure what it'll be at this point. But there will be an impact on inflation. You will see inflation go up. But most economists don't expect that to be a runaway effect like we saw in 22 and 23. It kind of be like a one-time bump, over the course of a few months. Let's say, for example, it might be like a 1% bump.
Why is that?
Well, because it's kind of like a one-time hit, if you think about it. It's kind of like it's a direct tax. Whereas the inflationary effects of 22, 23 were really like almost like a demand effect, where there was such high demand due to government spending, and because more money was flowing, there was more spending, more money, and it was a cycle that just kind of pushed inflation up to really high levels. But with a tariff, it's more like a one-time effect, so you see like a little bit of a jump.
And proponents of tariffs, or well, the president, right, might say that that one-time hit, or there might be some pain, as I think he was quoted saying recently. will be offset by gains. And if he's saying, well, we're going to make more things here, right? That, I think is what's we want to incentivize consumers to buy American products, and we want American companies manufacturing products using American workers and who would presumably would earn more, right? And so we might have wage growth related to that. I would assume that those are going to be union workers, and we'll have to remind the president of that. But that's kind of the gist of it, right? That's the flip side of tariffs, is that it might, if successful, stimulate an increase in domestic production. Is that fair?
The thought, yeah. It wouldn't be an overnight effect. I mean, there would be some small effects overnight over the next 6 months, say, where, all right, American companies would increase production to the extent that they could, but they can't produce everything you need overnight. There would be time they'd have to build new factories and build new production lines, and it takes time, and sometimes years. Sometimes 5, 6 years between planning a site, building a factory, getting it up and running efficiently, and a lot can happen in 7 years, right? So I mean, we can have tariffs now, and that's the kind of vision of the future. But in 2 years, that might be off the table, and that creates uncertainty. That creates uncertainty, and
That
we don't
seems
want
to be
that.
the bigger concern, right? Or even if I'm not building a factory, I have a factory and I'm going to hire up, maybe if I know this, if I'm an American producer of a certain auto part and it looks to me like I might be able to sell more product, more of my parts to Ford than I've been able to do so. I might be able to hire on, I might be able to do any number of things, but I want to know, and certainly if I'm going to build a new facility, I want to know, can I rely on this, right? How sturdy is this branch of the tree that I'm sitting on? And that's what I hear a lot about, is concerns about volatility, especially with a president who tends to change his mind a lot and very publicly, and has done so on this exact issue. Those seem to be the concerns that I'm hearing more so than the actual impact of the tariffs themselves. Does that make sense?
That does make a lot of sense. That does make a lot of sense. I mean, just from like the factory example, right? If you're going to spend, let's just say, $50 million on a new facility, well, you better make sure that once that facility is built, you're going to be in the same environment that you were when you made that decision to build it. And if you're uncertain that's going to happen, you just won't build that factory, and you'll just be stuck with tariffs and higher prices.
Or you'll wait it out and you'll say, oh, well, let's see what happens in the midterms in 26. Or maybe there'll be a different president in 28. Well, I mean, technically, there's supposed to be a different president in 28. We'll
Technically,
see
you
what
never know,
happens
right?
with that. There might be a very powerful vice president, but who knows? But that kind of blends into this. But the concerns about volatility, about stability, lead me to this other area of maybe some concern, and it's the stock market. And one, let's talk a little bit about some of the concerns. I mean, it looks like stocks are pretty much now where they were just before the election, right? The election hit, the market jumped. We had some growth, we had some down, and it looks like we ended the first quarter in the same spot we were in back in October of 2024. What does that reflect? What's your understanding on what that's reflecting? And are there any lessons that give us, or for the broader economy?
So the stock market is pretty much predicated, or at least the value of the stock market is predicated on the expectation of future cash flows. So if you were to have a new administration comes in who's very, pro government, I mean, I'm sorry, pro business, pro investment, the outlook is pretty good. You should see more cash flow, more business activity, so the stock market will go up. And that's what we saw after the election. A lot of optimism. A lot of expectations that there would be a pro-Brit business-friendly administration. However, in January, especially the latter part of January, some of those expectations were muted, and over the course of the first quarter have really reversed, because we're hearing rhetoric of high tariffs, a lot of unpredictability, and that expectation for economic activity and cash flows kind of went down. If all of a sudden now companies have to pay a tariff, profit margins go down, therefore cash flow goes down, and the expectation goes down, and therefore you see a reduction in the stock market.
Yeah, and that's what we've seen, right? And it seems to me like tariffs, that it's the tariffs of driving it more so than anything else, and that just the sense that we don't know. I wonder how many, these big businesses and these CEOs out there, thought that all the tariff stuff, notwithstanding the fact that Trump's been talking about tariffs since the 80s, right? Pretty consistently. How much they thought that was just all bullshit and he was never going to do it. Or he's going to use it as a bargaining chip, right? He's the deal maker.
I think that has a lot to do with it because, I mean, he ran on a platform of tariffs, especially against countries like China. But it was used as a negotiation tool, protection for labor and protection for intellectual property. And nobody really thought that, everything would be implemented. And it still might not. We don't know. And that's where all the uncertainty comes in.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary when you think about it. The guy ran on, tariffs. He ran on a number of things, right? Immigration got him elected, and inflation probably got him elected. And now you'd think the last thing he would want to do was jack inflation. But, he says, yep, we're going to go tariffs. Tariff's a great word. That's what we're going to do. And the vast majority of folks who voted for him and everybody else was like, nah, he's not really going to do that. And it's amazing that you can have a candidate that says that and nobody really believes him, without him saying that. And now he's doing exactly what he said he would do, and people are looking around saying, oh crap, or some people are maybe. But that leads to that uncertainty and volatility that we're concerned about. So at the local level, right? So our listeners to the podcast are, they got to negotiate contracts and they've had a few good years here. We pretty much have just talked about tariffs and inflation, the economy in general. What should our listeners be paying attention to, right? And how can some of these big picture things flow down to, their employers', ability to pay, this year or maybe next year?
Well, there's a few components to that. On the surface, right now, municipal finances are fine. They were strong last year, and they're continuing that trend now. So tax collections are fine. Government spending to municipalities, it's still flowing, although that's also some uncertainty that's been raised in recent weeks. But people are working, incomes are up, so income tax collections are up. People are spending. Sales tax collections are up. Unemployment's low, so people are working. They can pay their mortgage bills. They can pay their real estate tax. So right now, local municipal finances are pretty good.
Yeah. There's a it's a really weird disconnect between what we see in the media or the non-traditional media. It's all negative. And then when you look at the underlying data, it's all telling me the economy is actually pretty strong, but there are some reasons, to be concerned. And so I often get caught up on, consumer confidence or what, the media says, and, see how that really doesn't reflect what the economy's actually doing, but like at some point, those emotions, that emotional stuff becomes reality. If a city council people all think the economy is crappy, notwithstanding their revenue numbers, they're going to take a different mindset when it comes to bargaining. And that's why, folks who listen to this, you got to take a look at the numbers and really understand that and not let the rhetoric get you carried away, which is not to say that there aren't lots of reasons to be concerned, and to look at things. Any advice this year for our listeners? If they got a contract up, or what should they be paying? Should they be paying maybe particular attention to, out of all the noise that they're going to get about the economy? Any things that we should be looking for?
So, if I had to pick one thing, if I was limited to one thing, I was to keep an eye on inflation. And the reason is because a lot of the contracts that are being negotiated now, the last time they were negotiated was maybe 3, 4 years ago, right before that inflationary peak that we had. So this contract cycle, we want to play a little catch up, right? Trying to catch up some of those losses in real wages. And if inflation stays elevated, over the next year and over the next couple of years, that's something that really needs to be considered in those negotiations. It could be somewhere You want to negotiate an extra percent, try and get that because you have to make up for losses and potential losses in the future if if inflation stays elevated. So that would be the number one thing I would say to
Okay.
look at. And if I can say a second thing, keep an eye on consumer confidence.
Consumer confidence. I hate consumer confidence. I think it's meaningless.
See, here's the thing with consumer confidence. The U.S. economy is driven by consumers. So 70% of GDP is driven by consumers. And if consumers think the economy is bad,
Then it's bad.
then it's bad and they will spend less. And it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It is.
It is. It is. It's like, sometimes I joke around with other fellow economists and I say, yeah, sometimes you want, projections to be bad because it's kind of like, oh, we're projecting a recession, and then you do things to avoid a recession, and you don't have one, and then it's like, oh wow, the
We
bad
avoided a
projection.
recession.
Right. But so consumer sentiment though could really be something that could drive a recession if people think the economy is bad. They'll act accordingly, and it could lead to an economic downturn. So keep an eye on consumer confidence.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you raise people's expectations, so if you're running for election and you want to be supported by the great unwashed, and your policies don't actually help the great unwashed, then expectations are going to be dashed and confidence is going to go in the tank, and then the economy could go in the tank. So we got to be really, really careful about that. All right, so you're telling us inflation and consumer confidence are things that we should monitor. Okay, we will continue to monitor those things. And Jeremy, would you mind come back maybe in a few months or so, and let's see how things are going as we move through this year?
Oh, I'd love to.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks a million, man. I'll talk to you soon.
And thanks for having me. Take care.
Okay, that's the podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. We went all over the country, south, northwest, and then east. Talked about some interesting cases, and I'm not sure how I feel about the economy. We shall see. I think that was Jeremy's message, honestly, is like, let's just kind of wait and see what's going on. Hey, if you like what we're doing here, please subscribe or follow. Text it, to your friends so they can listen to the episode. If you have any things you want us to talk about, shoot me an email at info@lrs.com. And again, like I said earlier, if you're feeling charitable, maybe give us a review. That helps. You never know. Check us out at lrs.com. Hope to see you at an upcoming seminar. We're going to be in Vegas in June, September, October, and November. Big fun. Talk to you next month.